Let me just begin with a short, just a very, very short thought about Tu B'Shvat. The Gemara tells us that any tree whose fruits bud after Tu B'Shvat grew because of the rain of this year, because most of the rainy season has already passed. But if it budded before Tu B'Shvat, it is because of the rains of last year. And that is why Tu B'Shvat is the demarcation point between New Year fruit and Old Year fruit, because the budding of the fruit, which comes from the sap, if it's Tu B'Shvat or afterwards, comes from this year, the Cheshvan Kislev rains, and otherwise it comes from last year. The Chidushi Harim, the first Ger Rebbe, points out, Ki ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh, every person is like a tree. And he says, every Rosh Hashanah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides what our spiritual potential is going to be, and that's called Geshem. But until Tu B'Shvat, we are living off the potential of last year. So on Rosh Hashanah, God gave us a certain potential, but we do not draw on that potential till the 15th of Shvat. And therefore, the Chidush Harim says that a spiritually sensitive person is going to feel differently after Tu B'Shvat than before. Now, you might feel worse if, God forbid, the potential is less. It doesn't automatically mean there's an improvement, but it does mean there is a difference. So this is a great time for renewal, when we can access the unique kochos that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us. Be it as it may, we're still in our story, and you can see, by the way, this took much longer than I thought. We really devoted the entire session to this story. Hopefully, we will finish it today, because to wait 6 weeks till we continue, I think, would break the continuity. But once again, I mean, this is somewhat of a large story, but it's not very, very long, and yet you see that one can spend several weeks, and we have not exhausted all of the subtleties and ideas that are in this story. And one should just know that every single Agada of our Chachamim can take at least that amount of time to try to analyze and try to understand. So if you recall, we're back to this fundamental argument between Rabban Gamliel and the Chachamim regarding, number one, the nature of leadership, and regarding who should be admitted to advanced Talmudic study. Rabban Gamliel had a very demanding test of character and midot, and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was a little more tolerant, and because of this, hundreds and hundreds of people gained admission to the halls of Torah who would otherwise not study. And the Gemara tells us the following interesting curiosity that Rav Kook talks about as well, and that is, Bo Bayom, that very day, the very day that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was made the Nasi, that is when the tractate of Igios was redacted. Now, what is that? What is Maseches Igios? So Maseches Igios, or Egios, it's pronounced in different ways. Egyot, yeah, like Ayin, Ayin Dalet Yud Vav Tav, is a very, very interesting and somewhat enigmatic tractate. There is no Gemara on Masechet Egyot. It is a tractate in Seder Nezikin. And what does Egyot mean? There are two interpretations. It either means testimonies, a lashon of edut, or maybe it means edit. Edit means the choicest halachot. Like we say, the edit of the halachot. In fact, the Talmud actually translates idyot as bechirata, the choicest halachas. Now, what idyot comprises of is that various sages, whenever there were certain disputed areas of halacha, where one opinion says this and one opinion says this, various sages would actually come before the Sanhedrin and they would testify that this is the tradition that I received. And as a result, the halacha would be determined by virtue of an unbroken tradition. That is why it is called idyot, because it is what you might call halacha that is established by eyewitness testimony. Direct testimony regarding a mesorah. But again, I don't mean things that are reported in Yoteh Ne'aman or Jerusalem Post or whatever it is. We're talking about people who went before the Sanhedrin, and they testified that this was their tradition. And as a result, what's interesting about Maseches Idyot is there is not a single Mishnah, well no, that's not true, other than the first three Mishnayot, but after the first three Mishnayot, there is not a single Mishnah in Idyot that does not appear in another tractate. But what Idyot did was, Idyot gathered from all of the Shisha Sidrei Mishnah, all of the halachos that were established by testimony. And that is why when I said there is no Gemara on Idyot, that's actually a little misleading. In fact, there are many, many Gemaras on Idyot because simply every Mishnah in Idyot is somewhere else. One Mishnah in Idyot is Bava Metzia. Another Mishnah in Idyot is Nida. Another Mishnah is Yavamos, Ksubos, Gittin, Seder Tyros. Right? So essentially they have their Gemara wherever their Gemara is, but that's Maseches Idyot. So the Gemara is telling us, when did all of these testimonies take place? It did not happen over a long period of time. It happened in one day. Morning to night. Must have been a very long day because there are quite a few testimonies. People would come and give testimony one after the other, one after the other. And that means many halachot were decided that day. Because instead of there just being a machloket, we had unbroken traditions that we could then conclude were definitive. Rav Kook points out, what is the particular, Rav Kook tries to relate every single detail of the story to the central theme. Now you'll recall, Rav Kook understands the central theme is, what is the nature of a Torah community? Do we take the attitude, you can't really become a rabbi or a teacher unless you first have good midot? Or do we take the other attitude, that even if you're not so great, the Torah is going to make you good? And therefore, take him in and let the Torah influence. Rabbi Gamliel took the position that how can I accept somebody to an advanced yeshiva, a person who will be a leader and a rabbi in Israel, unless we already know they have good character? And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah took the position that the Torah can make the bad person good. Now, we discussed last week the various other sources on this question. But Rav Kook, who I said likes to relate every detail to the fundamental issue, connects Idyot as well, because he says the following. On one hand, it's true that a rabbi or a teacher or a Talmud Chacham or a Rebbetzin or a Rabbanit, so this would include men and women who influence people, cannot really be a spiritual mentor or guide if they themselves are arrogant, conceited, angry. How can a person who is selfish and egotistical teach someone how to be generous and kind? But Rav Kook says, you know, in Torah there are many, many levels. In Torah there is the Musar and the Midot and the spiritual influence. But there's also objective information. I might be arrogant and conceited, but I may know Hilchos Shabbos and I can tell you what to do. If, you know, how do you move Muktzah and how do you take the bones off chicken? Do I have to have good midot to be able to give you that information? Maybe not. So Rav Kook points out that it was precisely the day of open admissions that Idyot came to the fore. Because what is Idyot? Idyot does not require my personality or my spiritual essence. It simply requires me to report what I heard. And that could be very useful as well. So Rav Kook is pointing out, interestingly enough, that there is room in the Torah world even for people without good midot, provided they don't talk about character. Give the information. Give me the history of the Spanish Inquisition. Give me the history of the Kabbalistic movement. Give me the history of Hasidim fighting Misnagdim. I can hear you, okay? Give me that stuff. But don't lecture me on character and spirituality unless you're there. So Rav Kook sees in Idyot the idea that this is kind of a validation of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, that number one, Limud HaTorah can in fact improve a person's character. But number two, you know, even before they reach that point, they could have a utility in conveying objective information. Interesting point, meaning so people raise the question, can I learn from what you might call a fallen rabbi? Unfortunately, you know, both in America and in Israel, we have rabbis who are great, great spiritual leaders, people who are big influences on people. And it turned out, And really, we can't, I, God forbid, do not want to be arrogant about this, because everyone has the Yetzer Haris, and you know, there, but for the grace of God, you know, go perhaps any of us. But the rabbis seem to demonstrate that they did not necessarily have the proper midot. So the question is, can I still learn from them? So the answer is, it maybe kind of depends on what they're teaching. Meaning to say, I can learn information from them. I can learn halacha from them. I can learn specific things from them. But I shouldn't look to them for spiritual guides in life. And that's what Rav Kook says is what Edyot is about. That these extra students were worthy and able to communicate Edyot. Now that's an important point, because Rav Kook is basically saying, and this is of course consistent with his general philosophy, although as a teacher, he was obviously exceptionally great in his midot as well as his Torah learning. But precisely because of the greatness of his midot, he would never write anybody off. So he would want to find a place for everybody, even for fallen. You know, as they say, rabbis are people too. You know, the same rachmanut that we might extend towards any Jewish person who has made serious mistakes. Perhaps we should learn to forgive rabbis. Now again, I understand that people feel, rightfully so, that one who is a teacher of Torah should be held to a higher standard. But once again, we are human. So it's interesting that Rav Kook understands the whole story to give everybody a place to be able to use their talents in a good way. And that is the significance of Idyot. Okay. Then we go on. And the Talmud tells us, the Gemara tells us, that in spite of the fact that Rabban Gamliel was deposed, he continued to attend the sessions in the Beit HaMidrash. And again, this is quite remarkable, because this shows us that his autocratic leadership style, his dictatorship, so to speak, was not a matter of self-aggrandizement and ego, because if that would have been the case, he just would have left, and maybe he would have taken his supporters with him. But rather, it was a matter of principle. It truly was a matter of principle. But in terms of his personal dignity, once he was deposed, he accepted it, and he continued to participate in the discussion. That's a very important point. Rav Kook points out, this shows us that Rabban Gamliel was not acting out of personal gaiva, personal arrogance, because otherwise he simply would have left because he was insulted. And then the Gemara digresses and discusses a particular halachic issue that arose when Rabban Gamliel was sitting as a commoner. And it's very fascinating, because it's a bit of the tables being turned, right? Because in the other cases we had, it was Rabbi Yoshua who tried to say something and Rabban Gamliel shut him up. And here we have a little bit of spiritual poetic justice, where Rabban Gamliel, as the commoner, tries to say something, and Rabbi Yehoshua refutes him. Because now, they're equals, right? Now, Rabban Gamliel is no longer in that position of authority. So it's interesting that the Gemara wants to give us a little bit of poetic justice, where Rabban Gamliel is, in effect, refuted by Rabbi Yehoshua. And Rabban Gamliel accepts it. And the situation is the following. We know that there are two nations that descend from Lot. Remember, after the destruction of Sodom, Lot and his daughters had incest. Lot was drunk. Night one, it was his oldest daughter. And she had a child. And she named the child Moav, which is connected from my father. Second daughter did it the same second night. Had a child called Amon ben Ami, the son of my nation, a little bit more modest. And these became eventually the nations of Amon and Moab, who lived essentially in the east bank of the Jordan. And we are told that we were not allowed to conquer the land of Amon and Moab. In fact, the only portions of Aver Liardim that we got were portions of Ammon and Moab that had been conquered already by Sichon Melech Amori and Og Melech Bashan. Excuse me. So we were able to conquer that land, but the actual land that was under the rule of Ammon and Moab, we were not allowed to touch. Although we are told in the Gemara in Bava Basra, then when Mashiach comes, we will get that land as well. We will not just have the land of the seven nations of Canaan. We will have the land of the 10 nations. And the three extra nations are Ammon, Moab, and Edom, the land that belonged to Esau in biblical times. That would be pretty good for oil. That would be a large part of Saudi Arabia. Although by then we'll have our natural gas and we won't have to worry about that. Okay. Now, what does the Torah say about Ammon and Moab? The Torah says two contradictory things, moving in opposite directions. On one hand, we are not allowed to wage war with Ammon and Moab. We cannot harass them. We cannot hurt them. They are descended from Lot. God gave them that land until Mashiach. We do not wage war with them, unless, of course, they attack us first. And in the book of Shmuel, there were wars against Moab. But the second rule moves in the opposite direction. Lo yavo Ammoni u'Moavi b'kal Hashem. A convert from Ammon and Moab, a convert, he converted, is not allowed to marry into the Jewish faith. They have to marry other Ammonite converts or Moabite converts. And why is that so? Because like Kidmu Eschem, when you're wandering in the desert and you wanted food and water, and you were willing to pay for that food and water, they refused to give you that hospitality, in spite of the fact that they come from Lot, who was Abraham's nephew. And their lack of gratitude and their cruelty, it's a combination, a lack of gratitude and cruelty, makes them ineligible to enter the Kahal Hashem. Now all of you know that there is a major, major exception, that we darshan, it is only the male converts that cannot marry. The female converts can marry. And Rus HaMoaviyah was a female Moabite convert who married Boaz. And the great-grandson of Rus is, of course, David HaMelech. And from Rus will come the Mashiach. But the male converts cannot. And the Sfas Emes points out, we see from here how fundamentally important it is to have hakarat hatov and gratitude and kindness. Because Moab didn't do anything to us. Moab did not kill us. They're not Amalek. Moab did not attack us. They did nothing against us positively. But the cruelty and lack of rachmanut and the lack of hakarat hatov, remembering what Avraham did, disqualifies a person from connecting to the Jewish people, right? This is the halacha. So the scenario in the Gemara is a ger from the nation of Ammon walked into the Sanhedrin and posed a bit of a defiant question. Can I marry a Jewess? Rabbi Gamliel said, no, you can't. You're a ger from the nation of Ammon. And the Torah says, lo yavo Ammoni u'Moavi B'kal Hashem. That seems pretty cut and dry. But comes Rabbi Yoshua and says, you can marry anybody you want. Rabbi Gamliel, who is now a commoner, remember, he can no longer tell Rabbi Yoshua, stand in the corner. Rabbi Gamliel says, how can that be? The Torah says, lo yavo Ammoni. So Rabbi Yoshua introduces a principle that is halachically still a very valid principle. That is, at the time Sancheriv, the king of Assyria, exiled the 10 tribes, this was more than 100 years before the destruction of the first temple, he brought in different populations. And in fact, historians will tell you that Assyria, as a conquering empire, actually invented the idea of exile, the idea of moving around populations. Because the theory was that if he simply conquered you, but you were staying in your home territory, you would have the confidence and the wherewithal to rebel. But if he put you into a new place, you would be disoriented, you wouldn't be familiar, you would be less able to be. So he actually invented the notion of galut, of exiling. He exiled the 10 tribes, but not only that. He moved people all over the place. So consequently, the people who were living in Ammon were not the Ammonites, and the people who were living in Moab were not the Moabites. Yes, there are Ammonites, but they're mixed into the world's population. Consequently, when a person comes forward, what is the halacha? If you have a mixture and somebody separates from the mixture, we assume they come from the majority component of the mixture. If most Goyim in the world are not Moabites, then you can assume he's not a Moabite. So his chiddush is, even if you live in Ammon, and even if you identify in your Tudat Zehut, Ammoni, Moabi, that does not mean you are an Ammonite or a Moabite, because Sancheirev bilbel et kol ha'umot. But Rabbi Gamliel says, but there's another pasuk that says God returned the captives of Ammon, meaning Sancheirev's bilbul was undone. So Rabbi Yeshua says, well, you know, there's another pasuk which God also uses, Lashon Avar, and I have returned the captives of Israel. That hasn't happened yet. We're still in Galut. So it means it will happen. So this means it will happen as well. It has not happened yet. Meaning, God's promise is so reliable that he uses a Lashon Avar. Sometimes the Almighty will speak as if the promise was already Mekuyam, even though it hasn't been. So this was a little digression about the actual halacha in which Rabbi Yeshua won the day by establishing or by reiterating the principle Sancheirev was bilbel es kol ha'umas. Okay. The person was mutter lo bikal. All right. So now, Rabbi Gamliel was even more humbled by this, meaning not only was he deposed, but in a matter of halacha, he was refuted by a good argument. So he said to himself, I must take the next step in this debate. I must go to Rabbi Yoshua's house personally and ask him for his forgiveness. The halacha is, when you hurt a person, tshuva and Yom Kippur do not give you kapara until you seek the forgiveness of the person that you hurt, right? We all know this. Ein Yom Kippur mechaper ad sheyiratze eschavero. Rabbi Gamliel now wants to seek the forgiveness of Rabbi Yoshua. Derech Agav, let me just mention a very, very interesting machlokas between Rabbi Saul Salanter and the Chafetz Chaim about the idea of asking mechila when you've committed a sin of Lashon Hara against somebody. Let's say I said something very, very nasty about you, and I want to do tshuva, but you don't know that I said it. But I want to do tshuva because I hurt you. I hurt you in the sense that I lowered your reputation, I lowered your esteem in the eyes of the community or whoever I told it to. So what am I supposed to do? I go over to you and say, I really seek your forgiveness for the hurt that I've caused you. Now you don't know what it is. So you have the right to say, what is that? So what if I say, well, you really don't want to know. It's going to hurt you too much. But you don't have to grant mechila until you know. So the Chafetz Chaim actually writes, you want mechila, you got to say what you did. And then hopefully you'll get a mechila. Rabbi Saul Salanter said, it makes no sense to get your mechila by hurting the person more. So that's kind of the old expression, being a tzaddik on somebody else's cheshbon. In such a case, Rabbi Saul Salanter said, you do not tell the person what you've done. You do not even tell him, I did something that I don't want to tell you what I did. You simply don't do anything at all. You pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You basically say you're an anus. You're not able to ask mechila specifically because it would cause pain and suffering. And because you're not able to do it, you ask Hashem to forgive you, and you try to do tshuva in terms of being conscientious in not doing it again, and to whatever degree you can build a person up. That's what you do. Lashon Hara is an extraordinarily difficult thing to do tshuva for, really for two reasons. Number one, Lashon Hara spreads. How do you undo it? That's the famous story with the Chafetz Chaim. A man asked the Chafetz Chaim, what tshuva would I do for Lashon Hara? So the Chafetz Chaim says, I'll tell you exactly. Take a pillow that's stuffed with feathers, stand on top of the roof, shake out the pillow, and then the man said, okay, what next? Oh, put the feathers back. That's how you do tshuva for Lashon Hara. But there's another reason why you can't do tshuva as well. Even if you could contact people. You know, Lashon Hara is when it's true. How do you correct a true statement? You know, if I lied, I could say, I lied. I could, even though it's humiliating, I lied, what I said is not true, and maybe that's a ticket. But what if what you said was true? I say, you know, when I said that person is an idiot, I shouldn't have said it, although it is true, but you know, I shouldn't have said it. You know, in a way, there's even a saying in the legal system. The greater the truth, the greater the libel. It is much more difficult to correct a true statement, because how do you correct it, than to correct a false statement? You can't correct a true statement, because what are you gonna say? It's true, right? Unless, that's the question, are you allowed to lie? that's an interesting shaila. If I said true Lashon Hara about somebody, in order to rectify the damage, am I allowed to lie and say it wasn't true? Interesting shaila. Ask your rav about is it mutter to lie to be misake true Lashon Hara? Okay.
But you also have hearsay that is
no, yes, yeah, yeah. No, that's the first thing. First of all, you can't correct it at all. Especially if you think about, and today, the opportunities for spreading Lashon Hara are infinite. Put it on the web. You're gonna have 10 million people who see this Lashon Hara. And I just want to point out, to be in more serious vein, there have already been, not so much in the Jewish community as far as I know, but there have been suicides. And people, for example, people have been outed as gays or whatever it is. They have committed suicide. And there's even legal cases where families have sued the people who put things on the internet, true things on the internet, on the ground that it caused death. So when Mishlei says, Hachayim v'hamavet b'yad ha-lashon, life and death are in the tongue. This is actually a true reality. I mean, it is Meisim that actually happened. Okay. So be it as it may, Rabbi Gamliel is humbled. And he goes to ask Rabbi Yeshua's mechila. But here's the thing. He doesn't know where Rabbi Yeshua lives. Meaning, he never really got to know Rabbi Yeshua. And he discovers Rabbi Yeshua lives in a hovel. And Rabbi Yeshua is a blacksmith. See, in those days, we didn't have a professional rabbinate. In those days, even the great rabbis of the Sanhedrin, they were Sandler, Yochanan Sandler, they were woodcutters, Hillel was a woodcutter. Now, the Nasi was an exception. The Nasi, indeed, was a full-time position. But the others were part-timers, so to speak. And Rabbi Yeshua was a blacksmith. And as a result, he had fires and the walls of his house, he worked out of his home, and the walls of his house were black with charcoal. And imagine this, Rabbi Gamliel, you know, who was aristocratic and wealthy, because the Nasi was wealthy, comes in to the home of his nemesis, let's say, and he might be a little embarrassed. He sees this great rabbi who's living in poverty, and Rabbi Gamliel is trying to make small talk. One could imagine it was a little uneasy. And he says, I see that you're a blacksmith. Didn't know that. And Rabbi Yeshua just looks at him and says, alas to the generation for which you are the leader, and alas to the ship for which you are the captain. And the phrase of the Gemara is, let me just read the Lashon here, because there are two expressions that are going to be important. Oy lo lador, shata parneso, oy lo lisfina, shata kavarnita, She'ein ata yodea b'tzaran shel tilmidei chachamim. You don't know the pain and the suffering of the tilmidei chachamim of the generation. B'ma hein misparnesin. How do they support themselves? U'b'ma hein nizonin. And how do they get sustenance? And Rav Kook explains that there are two words that are used here for leadership. One is the parnes of the door, and one is the kavarnita, the captain of the ship. And he makes the point, Rav Kook says, that the parnes, which literally means the sustainer, is the one who gets involved in the individual lives of people. A captain of a ship doesn't, right? When you steer a ship, you know, if there are 100 people in the ship, they're all going to go in the same direction. And Rav Yoshua's merames to Rabban Gamliel, that if you truly want to be the captain of the ship, you want to direct Am Yisrael in the right way, you have to start with knowing individual people. You can't, as it were, serve the abstraction. In other words, paradoxically, you cannot be the captain of the ship unless you are also the parnes of the door. And that's an important point. You know, we talk about Klal Yisrael, and we talk about Reb Yisrael. There's Klal Yisrael, the needs of the nation. But you also have to be attuned to the significance of an individual. And he said to Rabban Gamliel, you didn't even know that I, and presumably other people, that we work, that we suffer, that we poor, that we're poor, that we struggle. You didn't know? This is a surprise to you? How can a person be a leader of a generation if he doesn't know what the individual families are doing and struggling? And that's the double expression. Alas to the generation that you are the parnes who is supposed to be involved in individuals, because then you cannot be the captain of the ship either. Because you can't determine the overall direction of the nation unless you have enough concern for individuals. So this is very, very stark mussar, that you have to care enough. It's like the famous Hasidic story about a person who was suffering, and some rabbi was not aware of it. And the person said, if you cared, you would know. There is somehow a concept that people who care know, they find out. Somehow they know. And often we have this question, I didn't know, I didn't hear. But when you care, you know. Eov's friends in the book of Job, all of these tragedies happen to him. And his three friends show up. Who told them? There was no email. They lived very far away. The Gemara says they just felt in their heart that something was wrong. I'm sure mothers here have probably had that, less so with fathers, but hopefully even with fathers, that sometimes you have a sense something's not right with your child. Telepathy. Because when the neshamas are connected, what happens to one neshama resonates in the other neshama. And you call up, right? It's a mother's intuition, which is a reality of neshamas being united at a very, very deep level. And that's what Rabbi Yeshua was saying. You didn't know? How could you not know? And again, obviously, I mean, giving mussar to myself as well. I don't mean to talk down to anybody. Okay. So, Rabban Gamliel says, forgive me. Be mochel me. Be mochel me for my arrogance. Be mochel me for my not respecting other Talmidei Chachamim. And be mochel me for not knowing all the struggles that you're going through. And be mochel me for not allowing people access to Torah, right? There's all of these things. Rabbi Yeshua said no. Or, well, it does not say he said no. It says, lo ashkech bei. He didn't respond. He's, you know, hitting the anvil. He's making his horseshoes or whatever the blacksmith is doing. He's just not responding. Rabbi Gamliel then changes his request. Be mochel me in the merit of my ancestors, not because I deserve it. but in the merit of my ancestors. Rabbi Yeshua says, okay, you got it. Now, Rav Kook explains the following way. What exactly is the argument? He says a very interesting thing. He says, Rabbi Gamliel initially was not fundamentally sorry for what he did. He was sorry for the pain that he caused, but he considered it to be justifiable. Which is an important lesson, by the way. And that is, even if our actions were 100% correct, if they hurt somebody, we should seek their mechila. But you see, not because what you did was wrong, but because what you did hurt somebody. So Rabbi Gamliel initially took the position with some justification. Everything he did was correct. He needed, remember we talked about in the aftermath of the destruction of the temple, we needed strong leadership. I had to be tough. I had to be critical. I'm sincerely sorry I caused you pain and humiliation. Forgive me, but I had to do it. That was the initial stance. On that, Rabbi Yeshua is refusing to forgive him. Because he says, if you don't admit that you're wrong, you'll just do it again when the need arises. It's not enough for you to say you were justified, but you're apologizing for the pain. You have to understand it was not even justifiable. That's the debate. So when Rabbi Gamliel says, I'm not deserving of forgiveness, forgive me because of my ancestors, he is saying, I was wrong. And that's what Rabbi Yeshua accepts. I was wrong. Now I would just add a little to Rav Kook. Rav Kook doesn't say this exactly, that maybe when it says, because of the Kavod Abba, the honor of my father, maybe it means his ancestor going all the way back, which is Hillel. And Hillel, we know, was the exact opposite of Rabbi Gamliel's leadership. Hillel was the kind one, the patient one, the compassionate one. And by Rabbi Gamliel invoking Hillel, perhaps, in Abba, he is acknowledging that his style was wrong. In other words, Rav Kook says, when I say forgive me, that might suggest I'm right in what I did, but I'm sorry I caused you pain. But when I say forgive me because of my zechus avos, I'm basically saying I was wrong. I don't deserve to be forgiven, but forgive because of that midah. And at that point, Rabbi Yeshua says, you're forgiven. You have grown. You have been transformed. And again, I hope you walk away with this type of Gemara, not only with condemnation of the different things Rabbi Gamliel did, but an admiration of the fact that he was willing to respond, willing to change, willing to acknowledge, willing to take the muster, willing to take the token. That's a tremendous madrega. Not too easy to do. One of the most difficult things in life is to accept a criticism and grow from it and change in a positive way. This is a great, great, great madrega. Very, very difficult. They tell the story, again with the Chiddush Yerim. The Chiddush Yerim was the first Sfar Rebbe. And the Chiddush Yerim lost many, many children. He lost 10 children in his lifetime, 10 adult children in his lifetime. But the son of his last surviving son, his little girl, became the Sfas Emes. And because the Sfas Emes, his father, died, the Chiddush Yerim raised the Sfas Emes as if it was his child. And he used to learn with the Sfas Emes. So one time the Sfas Emes was a little boy of 8 years old, and he missed the learning session. And he had a very important excuse. It was a medical emergency or something. He had a very, very legitimate excuse. But when his grandfather saw him, the grandfather started giving him mussar about how he can't waste time, he can't miss learning, he has to come on time, this is the most important thing. And he was very, very harsh in his rebuke because he considered the Sfas Emes a potential tzaddik. The mother, the Rebbetzin, came in and she sees her husband giving this very strong mussar to their little grandchild. And she says, what are you doing? He had an excuse. This had to be done. Why are you yelling at him? And the Chiddush Yerim looked at his grandson and said, why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you tell me? I wouldn't have spoken to you this way. And the little boy said, I so much wanted to hear your mussar, I didn't want to tell you I had an excuse. He says, I wanted to hear how I could be better. I wanted to hear how I could improve. Now most people, we like to make up excuses even when we don't have them. But here was a little boy who didn't want to use an excuse even though he did have it, because he wanted to hear the words of mussar. So I hope you walk away with an admiration for this quality as well. Number one, as I say, Rabbi Gamliel did have philosophical justifications for what he did as well. But he realizes it was not the right approach. Okay. So now we move into the next scene, our final scene. And Rabbi Yeshua now says, you know, maybe we ought to consider giving Rabbi Gamliel his old job back. Because now that he's learned what it means to be a leader, let's give him his old job. So they sent a messenger. Rabbi Yeshua sent a message. He didn't go personally. And the message was a bit of an enigmatic saying. Man de lavish mada. Mada with an aleph. He who wears the cloak of a leader, because this is really taken from Roman culture, in which the aristocracy had a special cloak. He who wears the cloak should wear the cloak. And one who does not wear the cloak should not say to the one who wears the cloak, take it off. Basically, leadership is described as a cloak, as a garment. And the argument was made, he who has the garment should keep it. Now, this is kind of a code, but it meant that Rabbi Yeshua basically said, we've made peace, give Rabbi Gamliel his job. Rabbi Akiva, here's what the messenger says. And he just gives an instruction, lock the door. Don't let this guy in. Don't let this messenger in. I'll explain how Rav Kook explains it. So Rav Yehoshua got news. They didn't let him in. So he comes himself, because they're not going to shut him out. He comes himself to the Beis HaMedrash, and he delivers a second enigmatic formula. And he uses Para Aduma. Right? We know if somebody is Tameh, so we mix tamei meis from a dead body. So there's a ritual in the Torah that's very mysterious, in which ashes of the red heifer are mixed with spring water, and they are a kohen sprinkles it on a tamei meis on the third day of the tumah and on the seventh day of the tumah, and then the person becomes tahor. So here is the question, or here is the quote: Mazeh ben mazeh. If a Kohen had the job of sprinkling people who were tummy, and he was the son of a person who had that job, right? He ran in the family, that they have this responsibility. Shall somebody dare say to him, your ashes are nothing more than the ashes of an oven, meaning they're not paraduma, and your water is rancid water? Of course not. He is a person who is in charge of the waters of the paraduma. You don't disqualify him and say everything you did is junk. And at that point, they accept it. Now, these are both enigmatic statements, right? Statement number one is, he who wears the coat should wear the coat and not be told to take it off. Second statement, and that Rabbi Akiva refused to accept. The second statement is, mazeh ben mazeh, here it brings in the father, mazeh ben mazeh, the sprinkler, the son of the sprinkler, shall he be told that your ashes are just the ashes of an oven, meaning not paraduma, and your water is the rancid water of a cave, not spring water? Of course not. And that they accepted. And they gave Rabban Gamliel his job back. I'll go back and explain these mamorim. But it does mention the following, that they didn't want to depose Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, because once a person is given the kavod, you don't take it away. So they made a compromise that they rotated in a 2-1-2 ratio. 2 weeks Rabbi Gamliel was Rosh Yeshiva, 1 week Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. It was 2-1-2-1-2-1, and we'll explain what that is, because you can't simply depose Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah because of Ma'alin Bakodesh V'ein Moridin. Okay, now, here is the thing. What is the meaning of these two enigmatic statements? And why Rabbi Akiva initially refused to listen to the first one, but he listened for the second one. So Rav Kook said, we've already discussed that the leadership of the Nasi has two separate functions. He is a political leader in terms of negotiating with the Romans and also in terms of politically setting up the internal structures of the Jewish community. But in addition to being a political leader, he's a Torah leader, the head of the Sanhedrin, the posek, the teacher of Torah. Now the cloak is a term that we commonly associate with political leadership. Indeed, it's a borrowed term from the Romans, in which those who were senators, right, the Roman Senate, they wore a special cloak. In fact, it was Techelet. In fact, one of the reasons why the royal blue of Techelet fell out of use in the Jewish community is that that was the color of Roman royalty, and it was a capital offense for a commoner to wear it. So Jews stopped wearing techelet because they could be killed, and then eventually we lost the way of how to make it, and Baruch Hashem, some feel we have recovered it, some feel not, but that is why it was lost for a long time. So Rabbi Akiva thought that what Rabbi Yoshua was proposing is, let's bifurcate the Torah leadership and the political leadership. Let Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah remain the Torah leader, and let Rabban Gamliel be the political leader. That's why he said, let the person who wears the coat wear the coat. And that, Rabbi Akiva said, was not acceptable. Because if you are minatek, political leadership, from a connection to Torah, the political leadership will turn out to be antagonistic, and they will try to delegitimate the Torah leadership. You should not separate the Torah leadership from the political leadership, and that would be a dangerous thing. Now, to me, I have to admit, this is one part of Rav Kook's analysis that I find very, very, very difficult, because in fact, I have a proof to the contrary. Yeah. That's correct. That's exactly right. And Rav Kook says that's exactly where you see the source of the problem. Very, very good point. In Babylonia, not in Israel, there was an institution called Reish Galutza, the head of the Galut, which was primarily a political office. Traditionally, they tried to get Reish Galutza that were descended from David HaMelech. And then there were the yeshivos, right? The yeshivos, the mesiftos. And you find, Rav Kook points out throughout the Gemara, that the Reish Galuta and the servants and the were always harassing the rabbis. They didn't have respect for the rabbis. They would persecute the rabbis. So Rabbi Akiva is basically saying, right, you're 100% correct, that you want to create a system similar to what later became the Reish Galuta, that's not going to be good for the world of Torah. You have to have a unified office. Now, but I just want to point out that I think there is a comment of Ramban in Chumash that goes in the other direction. This is a very famous Ramban, but this part is less famous. The famous Ramban in Parshas Vayechi discusses why the Hasmonean monarchy, which was started by the Maccabees, who were righteous, tzaddikim, they were so righteous and holy, why was it that they were so ignominiously destroyed, that literally there was no remnant left of them? Anyone who could, Herod was a slave to the Hasmoneans, and he was the only leftover. And indeed, the Gemara says, anyone who claims I'm from the Hasmoneans, the Hashmonaim, is a slave. How could it be? The Maccabees were tzaddikim. Why would they be destroyed this way? So the first answer the Ramban gives is the famous answer. Everyone has heard this answer. And that is, since Yaakov said the Malchus of Am Yisrael should only belong to Shevet Yehuda, the Hasmoneans, the Maccabees, after their victory, should not have assumed a monarchy at all. They should have looked for a descendant of David HaMelech or Shevet Yehuda and given the monarchy there. Because they assumed the monarchy, they were punished. This is the famous answer of the Ramban. But there's a less well-known answer of the Ramban. The Ramban gives a second answer. And that is, even if we assume you don't have to be of the tribe of Yehuda, there's a special prohibition for a Kohen to be a king. Mm-hmm. A Kohen should not be a king, because a Kohen must be a spiritual leader. And when a Kohen is involved in political leadership, that will taint the purity of his message, because he will have partisan considerations that will be there. Now, this is a truly fascinating idea, because I think it has implications regarding religious parties in the Knesset, and I think some of what the Ramban is talking about, we actually see, in which decisions are made based on money and power. And Lahavdil, the Catholic Church recognizes this. Pope John Paul, you know, two popes ago, issued a pronouncement in like 1980 that no Catholic priest would be permitted to occupy political office. And there's a very well-known congressman from Maryland, Robert Drynan, who was a Jesuit priest who had been president of Georgetown University, and he was a sitting member of Congress, and he was a very powerful member of Congress, and he resigned. He just had to resign his seat in the middle, because the Pope said, you're not allowed to be in politics. So what I'm having, this is a contrast, I don't have such a great answer here. In other words, what I see here is a little bit of a disconnect. On one hand, the proposal, let Rabbi Gamliel be the political person and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah be the spiritual person. So Rav Kook learns Rabbi Akiva rejected that because he said when the political leadership is not connected to the Torah leadership, there are going to be disputes and fighting and animosity. On the other hand, Ramban says that the positions are supposed to be separate. Yeah.
I think that you can find proof for that out of the ages. In the period of Vayishrishon, the prophets kept the king in check, and
yep.
The kings kept the prophets in check.
In what way did the kings keep the prophets in check? That's right. The prophet is the outsider. That's really true. In other words, that's the Ramban's concept. That the spiritual influence has to be outside the realm of power. And then, what is the expression? It speaks truth to power. Right, that's an expression.
And then you find, in the time of Vayishini, that was also true. By and largely, where rabbis were outside the, and could then serve as a moral check on the.
Because the Kohen Gadol and the Bayashani was primarily a political office, and the rabbis were outside of it.
King was primarily a political office.
Right.
And so the rabbis could serve as a.
That's correct. And again, as they say, it has very.
Something Rabbi Wein brings down. Historically, there's always been a separation.
But here, Rav Kook is suggesting that the separation is not a good thing. But I would give you an answer to that. I think maybe separation is not a good thing when the political leader is himself a Talmud Chacham. See, in other words, separation is good if the politician is a politician. But to take Rabbi Gamliel, who himself is a great rabbi, and say, you're only going to be the political leader, that, I think, is rife with conflict, because Rabbi Gamliel is not likely to defer to other Torah authorities. So maybe that's a special, unique question. Right? This would have been a problem, for example, if Rabbi Lau Sr. would have become president of Israel. I think there would have been some issue whether he would accept, you know, the decisions of the Rav HaRashi, because after all, he himself was the Rav HaRashi. Maybe that's an example of what Rav Kook would see as a difficulty when the political leader is a Torah person, but he doesn't have Torah authority, that could create a lot of conflict. So, the second mashal, this is where the second mashal comes in. The second mashal switches from the coat to the para aduma. Now, para aduma is spiritual purification, elevation, reconnection. Meaning, I wasn't suggesting that Rabbi Gamliel only get involved in political leadership, but rather he should be the mazeh, the purifier of Am Yisrael. And he has a certain zechus as well because of zechus avot, ben mazeh. And that Rabbi Akiva accepted because he understood that there would still be a spiritual component to Rabbi Gamliel's leadership. Now then Rav Kook says a very interesting thing, a kind of a little bit of a strange thing, because there are, part of what is true about all truly great thinkers is there are contradictions in their thought, in the sense that because they see so many sides to the different question, there will sometimes be, not inconsistencies, but in a holistic picture, different perspectives emerge. He points out that what is unique about Parah Aduma is it is a chok. It is inexplicable. We don't have the reasons for it. The idea, number one, why does a red heifer work at all? Number two, it purifies the impure and it contaminates the pure. And Rav Kook is suggesting that in Torah leadership, sometimes, there has to be the notion of not fully explaining what a position is. He quotes a Talmud Yerushalmi that says that in Eretz Yisrael, when the Sanhedrin would make a gezeirah, they would not explain the reason for 12 months because they wanted people to accept it as a practice. You see, once you give a reason, people start arguing with the reason. Now again, this seems a little inconsistent with the notion of reaching out and explaining, but Rav Kook said that leadership also requires sometimes that full explanations not immediately be given, because people need to learn the importance of obeying things. Now, even in medicine, this used to be the style, not so much today. The old-style doctor would tell you what to do, but wouldn't tell you why, and didn't even like to tell you why, because once he tells you why, you start arguing with him. Today, we live in a different society. People like to argue, and because of the internet, everybody is a doctor without going to medical school and the like. But Rav Kook says, in a sense, this is almost a concession to some of Rabban Gamliel's own personality. It's kind of saying, Rav Shua is saying, you know, sometimes you gotta give people the rule and don't go into all the qualifications. It confuses people. Now, I tell you, I've experienced this myself, and I'm sure almost all rabbis that teach halacha experience this. By personality and inclination, I want to explain. I want to say, this reason, this is the Araisa, this is Rabbanan. But what happens is, sometimes too much explanation, people walk away, they don't know the bottom line. Somebody was giving a shiur on meat and milk and pots that hadn't been used for 24 hours and pots that had been used for 24 hours and, you know, and all of the different leniencies that exist. And a very thorough shiur setting out exactly all of these different laws. So he told me a woman was walking out and says, I don't know, I thought you had to keep separate meat and milk. I guess you don't. You know. So in a sense, here is the concept. The Yerushalmi does not say don't give a reason, but you delay it a little bit. After people have internalized the practice, after it's become part of their everyday behavior, so they know what to do, they're not going to be confused, then you go back and explain. So explanations eventually have to be forthcoming, to be sure. But initially, it might be sometimes more important to internalize behavior, and then you go for explanations. And Rav Kook says that is the secondary remez in mazeh ben mazeh, and that is, number one, it's Torah leadership because it's purification and elevation. But number two, a certain amount of enigma built into that leadership, in which not everything needs to be fully explained at once, because information overload can be very, very confusing. But I would add, eventually explanations do have to be forthcoming. So we're not talking about not explaining, we are talking about deferring, delaying, so people can internalize a certain practice. And this is really the end of our story. The very last line of the story is it finally tells us who was the fellow that started all of this trouble with his question about Tfilat Arvit Rishuto Chovah. So we're not even told. Until now, he was just identified as the Talmud. None other than Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Now, it could be the Gemara held to reveal him as the starter of a machloket would have been Lashon Hara. We don't want to say who he is at the beginning. But at the end of the story, when everybody is reconciled, everybody is b'shalom, it is now safe to reveal his identity. And Rav Kook just points out and we'll just end here, that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, of course, was the great mystic, the author of the Zohar, the one that had great, great revelations. And Rav Kook's understanding of Tefillat Arvit is that during the day, we serve God by doing mitzvot and by and the like, but at night, we are capable of prophetic revelation. We're in solitude. We're away from the busyness of life. We're away from the noise of the mundane. And that is where one could achieve prophecy. And therefore, it is precisely someone like Rav Shimon Bar Yochai that is saying, is this a mandatory thing? Or is this optional? And the short answer is, for most of us, it's optional because we're not capable of those levels. But this was a level to which he aspired. So Rav Kook looks at the night prayer as the harbinger, the precursor of prophetic revelation when you are away from the distractions of the day. And that is why he was so interested in understanding, is this an obligation that every Jew has to try to be a prophet? Or is it only for Yechidei Sgula? Okay, it will all be well, and we will continue eventually. Thank you.
Is there any way of knowing when you'll be giving
a public shiur? In what? Generally?
Yeah.
No, it's hard for me to know. You can email.